Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football, history and its memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. We're live from the Wallingford, Connecticut home of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 140-plus years of football history and memorabilia. And you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. For one of the largest selections of football cards and football memorabilia on the web, please check out their website at msbsportscards.com. And we're also sponsored in part by BST Auctions. Check out their website and make sure you register for their upcoming auction at bstauctions.com. Now, tonight, I'd like to introduce my special guest co-host, who is a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia and card collector, historian that has an incredible collection of pre-World War II items, in particular the 1925 Pottsville Maroons. I'd like to welcome to our show tonight Mr. Jeff Payne. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob. How you doing today? Great to be here.
I'm doing good. Thanks for filling in today. Joe had a previous engagement and wasn't able to make it, so I appreciate you filling in on short notice here. And I'd like to start off tonight by talking a little bit about your incredible collection of items, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the history and also some of the memorabilia that you have from a very, very fascinating team that hopefully some of our audience has heard about. And I know we're going to educate quite a few of our listeners tonight on the 1925 Pottsville Maroons. Jeff, I'm going to hand off to you. Give us some background as far as what is the 1925 Pottsville Maroons? Why are they important? So on and so forth.
Yeah, sure, Bob. So, the Maroons were a professional football team that was around in the 20s. They started around 1920 and went through the decade. They did play in the NFL from 1925 to 29. Before that, they were an independent team, played other coal region teams in Pennsylvania and were part of what was called the Anthracite League prior to joining the NFL. Now, their real claim to fame, of course, and there's been a couple of books written about it, including The Breaker Boys, which is a great book I recommend to people. It talks about the controversy around the 1925 NFL championship, where, the Maroons had the best record in the league throughout the year and thought they were in position to win the championship by closing out their season, but they were suspended from the NFL. And were not able or allowed to complete their season, and because they were suspended, were forced to forfeit what they thought was their NFL championship. And the fascinating thing wasn't just that; it was that the people of Pottsville, later on, as the players and people associated with the team were getting older, decided to rally and try to see if they could convince the NFL to give them back this championship that they felt that they lost. And so from the early 60s through the early 80s, they staged reunions, they put pressure on the league, on the Hall of Fame, and they tried really hard to get the NFL to reward them and give them a championship that they felt they deserved. And unfortunately for them, it never happened. So it's a fascinating story. And I know there's been rumors of a movie coming out about this team, and that would be really awesome if it was produced.
It would be an incredible story to be told. And again, because it happened such a long period of time ago, it's kind of a forgotten history of the NFL, the very early days of the NFL. And I've always been a big believer they should be reinstated for the championship. There's no reason why they shouldn't be denied it. But I guess that's kind of water over the dam right now, because I don't think it's going to be happening anytime soon. However, the history of the game, the history of that team lives on, and there are very, very nice pieces of what I feel are very, very rare historical items of that team. And let's talk a little bit about their short-lived seasons, and in particular some of the pieces of memorabilia that might or might not be still in existence, although I know for a fact with some of the things that you have in your collection, they do exist. So obviously the initial items are football programs of that game time. What can you talk about as far as about the programs?
Yeah, there are some really nice programs out there from their early days in the NFL. And even before the NFL, you'll see programs pop up when they were independent and playing in the Anthracite League. They are out there. They come up on eBay. They come up on auction, not real frequently, but I'd say a couple times a year you'll see a vintage program from the Maroons. They're not cheap. You know, the Maroons, because of the Breaker Boys book and the other they get, you know, you're typically looking at $750 to $1,000 plus to get an NFL program for the Maroons. It is one of the more popular teams in terms of, you know, programs and people wanting them, but they are right out there if you're interested in them. It just will cost you a little bit.
And I'll tell you, I think you brought up a good point. As far as I'm concerned, they're very, very reasonably priced if they are only $750 to $1,000. Because as far as I'm concerned, how many actually still remain in existence after all these years? Maybe 15 for each game. Who knows? You know, 20. You know, pick a number. We have really no clue of how many are still out there. And one thing I want to point out to our listeners also, I think most of us realize that the NFL program of the 1920s is vastly different than the NFL program today. And Jeff, describe a basic NFL program from the 1920s. It's pretty simplistic, I would say.
Most of them really are. I mean, it's really typically almost a fold out. Most of them are just a front cover with, you know, the name on the team, maybe the date and the team they're playing. Sometimes they were generic front covers that were used, like the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, who didn't put really any information on their front cover. They used the same cover for all their games. Each year they had a different cover usually, but same. And then inside, usually it just had a real simple, you know, lineup. In the middle, there may or may not be some additional pages around it with advertising and maybe an ad for an upcoming game. You know, I've seen a few programs where they had inserts in them that were advertising an upcoming game. So the program was more generic, and then they were either stapling a lineup in the middle or an insert or both. But very simplistic, almost to the point where the early 20s programs are really just fold out. You know, single pages, you know, 11 by 18 that were printed and folded with a front and back cover and a lineup in the middle.
Right. So that, not to shock anybody who's never collected a 1920s NFL program, there is very little there other than what has been described. So you may say to yourself, well, gee, I'm not going to spend $1,000 on a basic, you know, sheet of paper folded in half. But again, it's historical. And in my opinion, they're very, very rare, to say the least. Now, tying into the programs were and what are ticket stubs or tickets like from, let's say, Pottsville? Do you have any in your collection? Can you describe any? What are they? What do they actually look like? So on and so forth.
Yeah, so I do have, I believe, one or two Pottsville tickets. They're a lot harder, in my opinion, to find than even the programs are.
Right, right. I agree with that.
Yeah, they're very difficult to find. And a lot of the early NFL teams, the tickets are very difficult to find. And you'll find most of them, of course, because they were redeemed or torn. Or stay punched or whatever was used to, verify that someone had used the ticket when they entered the stadium. And a lot of times, the stubs don't even have the information on that piece of the ticket as to the game itself. And so you have to really dig to figure out what ticket it even and what game it even is from. So it's kind of a puzzle, in my opinion, a lot of times when you see ticket stubs to figure out, really what game they were associated with. And I've seen a lot of ticket stubs that the description in the auction isn't even correct. You dig into it and it's just wrong. Either they were guessing or someone gave them bad information. But when you look into it and finally track down, something about the ticket that makes it unique, they don't even have it described properly.
Right. I agree with that. And I think the college football tickets of that era were better produced. They were more ornate, and they had much more information on them than what we saw, what we see from the NFL from the 20s, to say the least. Is there anything else out there that you know of, or you could describe to our audience as far as memorabilia and/or possible items that have historical significance to Pottsville?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, a couple of things that I really like. From my collection and other people's collection is in 1926, the Maroons published a real photo postcard set of their players, an RPPC set of the 18 players on the team. And they are really hard to find, but it is an early NFL professional football card set. And you just don't see in even the 20s and 30s, football card sets that are all professional. A lot of times they have colleged in, or it's a multi-sport set or whatever. It is team related, but it is an all professional, football card set, albeit postcards.
Right.
And they're extremely hard to find. I've spent the better part of the last decade trying to find them because they are really hard, really difficult to find. You'll see the images, interestingly enough, the photos that they made these postcards out of are very common photos. In fact, they show up in the reunion books that were produced when the Maroons did reunions in the 60s, and they built some, or they created some really nice reunion programs that people got when they went to the reunion, and they used those same photos, which is kind of cool to see them used all those years later. Those are great things to collect, by the way, too, for those that, don't want to dip their toe all the way back into the pre-war stuff. There is some pretty healthy amount of reunion material that's out there from the 60s that you can get for this team, too. The other thing I really love that was produced back in the 20s was the football charms. So after the 1928 season, as a thank you to all the players, the Maroons had little mini anthracite coal footballs created, and they sketched name and their position and the year into them. And they were meant to put on a charm bracelet or some sort of a, charm that it was a charm you could put on things. And they gave, as far as I can tell, out one to each player. So there's really only, there were probably only 15 or 20 produced, one for each player.
Right.
I think there's been about three or four that have popped up over the years. I was fortunate enough to snag one myself from Pete Henry, who's one of the Hall of Famers that was on that team. And also played for Canton. There's been a few others that have popped up, and they're really cool as well. It's a really nice piece.
All right, I'm going to step back to the postcards. A lot of collectors, as they become more advanced collecting, start to discover, in my opinion, the beauty of a lot of these early postcards, and especially real player postcards that, you know, do exist, and they do come up from time to time. I do issue the warning, though, there have been reprints over the years of the postcard.
Mm-hmm.
Postcards, and again, you know, you have to really do your homework to make sure. If something looks too new, it probably is a reprint, and it was probably a reprint possibly from the 40s or the 50s, not done maliciously at that time, but just done so that they could issue the, you know, the photo again type of situation. As we become more advanced with technology and the like, postcard, you know, duplication has become much more sophisticated at the same time, with a lot of sepia toning being done on postcards to try to pass them off as real when they're, you know, basically just a reprint worth whatever printing cost was for it, and that's it. So, again, I do warn, and I've talked about this over the years, you know, make sure if you're purchasing a postcard, you know, do you have any providence to it? You know, does it, you know, what examine it real closely. Obviously, if it was mailed, make sure the postmark and the stamp is of that era, so on and so forth. Do your research on that at the same time. So that's important as far as I'm concerned, because, again, it was very common at that time to actually mail postcards out, especially after, more so in a college game, after the game was ended, maybe one or two photos were printed on a postcard, and then they were used so that you could be mailed out to your friends saying, I attended the game, here was the score, so on and so forth. So it's a great area of collecting, to say the least. Those football charms that you mentioned, too, are absolutely beautiful. I mean, they are to me, rare, to say the least. So real great, interesting items for them. Anything else that you can touch upon, Jeff?
Yeah, the only other thing, and this does date to the 60s, but I just think it's really cool, is the whole argument the Maroons had around the, you know, why they were shouldn't have been suspended from the NFL was they had played an exhibition game, and the NFL claimed they hadn't got permission to do it, and they claimed they did, and it went back and forth. Part of their case in the 60s was to submit some notarized statements from people that were in the room when the owner of the Maroons called the NFL to get permission. The what transcribed and what was discussed on that call is documented in these notarized statements. And there were two people in the room other than the owner. The owner had passed by the 60s, but, you know, Potsdam was able to get two notarized statements. And I was fortunate enough to pick one of those up at auction. It was in a huge just bin full of papers and other things that came out of the estate of someone from Pottsville. And I was able to get one of those pieces, which I think is just really cool. And I'm glad it didn't end up in the dump somewhere, because it is an artifact, you know, that should be preserved for the NFL.
Right. And again, I was blessed to see some of that stuff a few weeks ago. And to me, it's just amazing historical items of the early NFL. I mean, it's a shocking to me to see what was perceived as junk, because some of those pieces are just amazing, truly amazing. And again, this is the preservation of the history of the game, and this is what, you know, what I think our hobby is about to a large degree, especially when it comes to the early NFL stuff, which I think to me is you know, studied by few and pretty much disregarded by the NFL today, especially, you know, the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. And it's just an amazing story. So, Jeff, I appreciate you sharing that with us tonight. It's really an incredible story. And I highly recommend, you know, if anybody's interested in the Pottsville teams of the 1920s, do some research on it. There's some great information out there. And items out there still available, which are very expensive, however, to me, are so historically significant. It truly amazes me, to say the least. All right, at this time, we're going to move along, and I'd like to welcome our special guest, growing up overseas in Portugal, there's only one football game on television the entire year, and that's the Super Bowl. So the first football game he watched was the Super Bowl game between the Philadelphia Eagles and the New England Patriots in 2004. His background was pure football, the other one that's called soccer. He had played and watched soccer all his life until he suffered an injury that devastated his dream. He then went on to be the youngest basketball scout at that time. He was 15 years old, scouting American players to play overseas, and in particular in Portugal. But the sport that truly mesmerized him was football. He started researching more about the history of the game, falling in love with the Philadelphia Eagles from that night in 2004 when the Super Bowl ended at 4 a.m. in Portugal. In 2009, he arrived in the United States by himself, and 9 years later, he achieved a Bachelor's of Criminal Justice degree from Penn State, and afterwards a Master's degree in Criminal Justice from Arizona State. But his true passion and hobby is collecting Philadelphia Eagles memorabilia, and by the way, he's only 29 years old. He specializes also into the history of the Pottstown Firebirds, which was the Eagles' farm team from 1968 to 1970. Preserving the history, stories, and memorabilia, his long-term goals, one day holding a physical building where both Eagles and Firebirds items can be displayed for everyone to enjoy. He learned in Europe all the soccer teams there honor their history by holding museums inside their stadiums, a practice not yet used in American sports except for a few teams. He currently works as a security officer with the goal of working for Homeland Security Department, as he is in the process to acquire double citizenship. He's married with a son. He devotes himself both to working, spending time with family, and learning more and more each day about the history of football. He is the keeper of the history of the minor league football team, which is known as the Pottstown Firebirds, and has just written a new book on them entitled The Greatest Stories Never Told, The Detailed Chronicles of the Pottstown Firebirds. It is at this time I'd like to welcome Mr. Bruner Balthazar. Bruno, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. A pleasure being here.
Bruno, I'm going to start off by asking you, how did you become interested in the Pottstown Firebirds?
Well, as those who have heard about this team before, they probably have heard it from the NFL films. In 1970, Mr. Ed Sable himself decided to pick a minor league football team to follow. And initially, it was just supposed to be a 30-minute short documentary. As he got to Pottstown, he ended up finding different characters, and he ended up following the team the entire year. So he ended up producing a one-hour special that initially was aired in the 1972 Super Bowl. Many years later, I'm flipping through the TV channels, and I stop at ESPN Classic. This was about 2010. And on ESPN Classic, they were re-airing their 1972 special about the Pottstown Firebirds documentary. And so, I'm watching it, and the first thing is I'm a Philadelphia Eagles fan and memorabilia collector. The first thing I notice is their uniforms. They seem awfully similar to the ones that the Eagles wore at that time. So I ended up watching the show, and the characters, every player seemed to have their own personal identity that was quite interesting, to say the least. And as soon as the documentary finished, I was recording it as well as I was watching it, and I replayed it. And as I replayed it, I started researching more online what exactly this team was. And as soon as I found out that they used to have the old equipment from the Eagles, then I started this research. Okay, I need to find out who were these guys exactly, how these guys acquired the equipment, who is this team, is anybody still alive, can I find any game-used items from this team? Because most of the memorabilia from the 60s, from the Eagles, it's quite hard to acquire, especially their helmets, which their helmets have the wings painted instead of the decals that they used in the 70s. So from then on, that's when I started researching more. When I first went online, I could barely find anything about the team. It was very scarce information. There was not a lot of stuff out there. So, but I became interested really out of that documentary, which then later I find out that they did a revisited edition. In 2000, they visited the team 40 years after they did the first part, and then they went to see what happened to everyone all these decades later. So that's on a DVD that the NFL films have. They were so interesting that really the 1972 pre-Super Bowl all-time pre-game show was so popular that really created a path to now all the pre-game shows and the all-time shows we have in the Super Bowl. People really enjoy that special.
You know, it's, to date myself, I got a few years on you, Bruno. I do remember distinctly listening to Hartford Knights football here in Connecticut, and I do remember them playing Pottstown on several occasions, and the old WTIC radio here in Connecticut, it was 50,000-watt station. So for a young kid in North Branford, Connecticut, growing up, they used to play on Saturdays, usually Saturday nights, and they broadcast their both home and away games. So it was the coolest thing for me to listen to football on Saturday night. And I had my little transistor radio, and I distinctly remember I was a big fan of the Knights at that time. So I find this your interest in Pottstown to be amazing at your age, because to me, a lot of people kind of just forgotten about that league to a large degree, and the great, great players that came out of that league. And again, it was what a lot of historians may or may not know, and a lot of collectors may or may not know, it was an actual minor league for professional football at the time. And it's pretty much, it faded in the 1970s completely. And at the same time, you know, I've always maintained football needs a great, some sort of minor league system like the other sports. And I don't understand why they use colleges as their minor leagues rather than anything else. But that's a fascinating story, to say the least.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because the Knights and the Firebirds had probably the biggest rivalry in 69 and 1970. As a matter of fact, the 1970 championship was supposed to be taking place in Pottstown, but they moved it to Hartford because they thought that the players were getting a cut on the ticket sales. So both teams agreed that they would sell more tickets in Hartford. And then that 1970 game became the famous snow game, where it's well documented how bad the snow was around the stadium, and the fans still showed up more than they would have shown up in Pottstown. But and regarding the minor league system, it's curious that nowadays we see college as the minor leagues of the NFL. But as you say, I mean, especially this league, the Atlantic Coast League, as you said, the Knights, for example, they were affiliated with the Green Bay Packers. And they weren't the only ones. The Bridgeport Jets were affiliated with the Jets from the AFC. The Long Island Bulls were affiliated with the Giants. The Lowell Giants were affiliated with the Boston Patriots. And then you had the Southern Division, which had Roanoke, the Redskins. They were affiliated with the Redskins. The Firebirds, obviously, with the Eagles. The Harrisburg Capital Colts with the Baltimore Colts. And the Richmond Roadrunners with the New Orleans Saints. So it's actually interesting that these leagues actually not only had affiliations with the NFL, but they also had affiliations with the AFL. Which most people didn't know, but both leagues, they were rivalizing. They were actually united in the ACFL, which was, to me, quite... Bob Tucker, he played for the Firebirds in 69, and then he went on to play for the Giants for 7 years in the Vikings, all the way down till 1970. And who's to know if it wasn't this minor league system, if you'll never see players like that actually having the chance to go to the NFL. So a lot of talent was gathered in this minor, so-called minor league, and the NFL was able to reach out to it and reutilize them, which to me is great. And I still agree that they should exist. Some type of league should exist But yep. unfortunately, the NFL likes to monopolize the league.
Right.
That's fascinating stuff, Bruno. You know, your Super Bowl story resonates with me. You know, I got to confess, I'm a lifelong Patriots fan, so, you know, we probably don't get along on the field. But I remember that game. I remember that game you were watching from Portugal because we had gone to a Super Bowl party, which I wasn't very excited about because I really didn't want to stand around and talk to people. I wanted to, like, watch the game since I had kind of an interest in it. And we got there, and almost everybody there was an Eagles fan. So I was like, well, this isn't going to work for me. So I stayed and had some food and kind of played with the kids for a little bit. And then I told my wife, hey, would you mind kind of hanging out with the kids while they run around? I'm going to go back home and watch in the basement. And so I went back, and so when you were watching the game at 4 a.m. in Portugal, Bruno, I was hunkered down in my basement in Virginia by myself, biting my fingernails, you know, watching that game. So, but I got to know, I mean, I got to ask you, though, the Eagles lost. I mean, you should be a Patriots fan and you should be a Hartford fan. What happened there? And more seriously, you know, how did you come up with an idea to write a book about all this? I'm kind of curious. I've worked with authors. It's a huge endeavor. How did you decide to write a book?
So to answer you, it's funny, though, because I was looking right before the Super Bowl. They had the Road to the Super Bowl. It was like a one-hour documentary. And I was like, okay, so I definitely got to pick a team. I'm going to watch these games, so I'm going to pick one of these two teams. I just liked the way the Eagles, the road, they were telling the history of the Eagles. They never won a Super Bowl. They really only won the last time was the 1960 championship. So I decided to root for the underdog, per se. So I'm going to root for the ones that have not won the longest. And that's how I became an Eagles fan. But I guess to a certain extent, I became an Eagles fan because they were more not as winners as the Patriots were at that time. Regarding the book, I started speaking with so many different players. They were telling me all these interesting stories. It has gotten to the point where I had so many stories that to me they were interesting that I thought that they would only not be interesting to me, but to the football lover, to the football historian, but more importantly, to the average Joe, because these were stories of people from the 60s trying to figure out life. These were just young kids coming out of college with a goal in mind, but not knowing how to reach this dream that they had into an actual goal, into actually reality. So they were willing to do basically whatever it took, but on their journey to do whatever it took to succeed, they were also living life. And these stories of living life, to me, were very interesting. And of course you got the King Corcoran, which he was by himself a true character, to say the least. And then around him, it was this plethora of people too that they were coming from all parts of America into this little town that probably nobody really has heard about, Pottstown, 45 minutes outside Philadelphia, into probably a weather that isn't even very appealing to be in. And I get stories from these guys who were working in Baltimore. Some of the players were in Baltimore, then they had to drive 100 miles just to go to practice, then go to practice three times a week, come back every day back to Baltimore to work, and then on Friday nights, go to drive right before the game and then go to a locker room of a high school football team that they were renting, put their pads on, then play. After they play, they have a big bucket full of beer and they just drink all night long and then they go drive back to where they're from. These different, it was just a different environment. Even football was different, not just in the minors, but also the NFL. It's interesting that one of the stories that I came across, the most cheerleaders were actually minors. They were under the age of 18. Some of them were 14, 15, 16, 17 was about the average. And it's quite interesting that as soon as I found out, I thought it was it was different. Because in today's world, when we imagine cheerleaders, we imagine 20-year-olds, and there's a certain stigma connected to it. So when I started hearing that, I was like, okay, is this a typo on the newspaper? Is she really 16, or they just messed up? And then I was able to reach out to some, and they were like, no, I was 16, 17 years old. And I had a good time. I was dancing out there. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was dancing, and people appreciated it. And then I decided to see what the Eagles were doing at that time. Were the Eagles cheerleaders also 16, or were they 20, 25? And I came to find out, too, that in 1969, most of them were also under the age. So it wasn't just that it was a Pottstown thing. It was also an Eagles thing. And all these little bits and pieces of I call it Americana, like American history, that most people, I don't think, were aware of it. That's what really triggered my interest of writing a book. Now, writing a book, as you said, it is something very hard to do, especially for someone that English is not their first language. Is even harder to do that. And I can attest that when I started gathering these stories, I really didn't know what direction I was going. I had so much information, but okay, now I need to make these into sense. These needs to make sense. And so it took me, I want to say about nine to 10 months to actually put something together. And most of the time it wasn't even writing. It was just deciding what exactly I wanted to write, what stories I wanted to pick. Was I going to do Eagles versus Firebirds at that period of time in comparable teams in both worlds of football? But as I started talking to more people were like, you got enough history here for the Firebirds, enough stuff that has not been said more about the Firebirds than the Eagles, because there is stuff out there about the Eagles. Even though I must state that Jay Acton wrote a book called The Forgettables, which is a book about the 1970 season of the Firebirds. I actually had read the book many years ago, but I didn't really remember the stories. And the way I did to write this book is I didn't touch their book whatsoever because I didn't want it to get any ideas from their book. So whatever this book has, really, it doesn't transplant to what the old book is from Jay Acton. For those who know what that book is, and for those who don't know what that book is, I recommend it because Hollywood also considered making a movie out of it in 1974. They acquired the rights for it. They even went to Pottstown, some Hollywood executives, and they wanted to record the movie down there, but it ended up not happening for some odd reason. But it's a great story, and it's still a timeless story because we can all connect. Anyone can connect the struggles and the things that they do and they have to go through in order to achieve their dreams and their goals.
That's interesting. We've had many authors on the podcast over the years, and many of them have said that the actual writing of the book didn't take that long, but the research that was involved in it took the most time. And you touched upon, realistically, you know, if you spend 9 or 10 months on research of a topic, of a subject, and it takes a very short period of time for you to write it, it's still an excessively long project one way or the other. And to have to come out, you know, is certainly a great feeling to say the least. So I take it that it took you, what, roughly nine to 10 months to do the research on it?
Actually, no, that was just more or less the writing process. Everything started in that day in 2010 when I saw the documentary. The first thing I did, it was I went to Facebook and I tried to research if any of these former players were on Facebook, because it was the easiest way for me to get. Yeah, and then I actually got the chance to talk to Irby Knowles, which unfortunately he has passed away. But from then I got the connections from other guys. And it wasn't until about I want to say last year that I started researching more, finding one guy here, one guy there. There's even one person that lives in American Samoa, one of the former players.
Oh, wow.
And so, from one, I was able to get the network that he had to find more from that person. And so it became like a little connection that at first the players were reluctant because, as you know, the first thing they hear from my voice is someone with an accent. And there has been people before that somehow, some way, had claimed that they had something to do with the Firebirds, and they tried to make profit out of stories that they made up. And so they were quite reluctant at the beginning to trust me and to share their stories. But after a while, and they saw that I created a website, that I asked about the Firebirds and so on, they were able to open up more and trust me more, because some of the stories are not necessarily stories that they might be proud of because they were young. But if they trust the writer and that the writer has their best interest, then they will open up more and they will tell you more fascinating stories. So in all said and done, it really was a project that has took about 8 years, but more seriously in the last year, that's where the main research has occurred.
Okay. All right. And again, how long did it realistically take you after the research was done for you to actually write the book?
I want to say 2 months and a half to 3 months.
Okay. All right.
It was quick. As soon as I had everything and I would record the conversation over the phone, I'll just record it because they were the ones that knew the stories. I only basically had to organize it, where to put in which stories to pick.
That's fascinating. So the collector in me has got to ask you, Bruno, you know, Philadelphia Eagles, it's a franchise that's been around for a long time, back to the 30s. Do you collect things from the Eagles? And what kinds of things are in your collection? What kinds of things are you looking for? And kind of what do you collect from the Eagles side of things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I have quite a few items. Of course, not as much as I wish I had. I don't focus so much about the more recent stuff. I like the old stuff. The back then where one helmet was worn for maybe 5-6 years. A jersey was worn for 1 to 2 years instead of these days. Seems like a jersey is worn each game. They wear a different jersey. So I like the old stuff because the jerseys, the marks of use, the stitches, the restitches on the jerseys, and everything, they tell a story. They tell a battle story. So I love the old equipment, and I love the silver wings on the Kelly Green helmets. It's to me, I don't want to sound older, but to me, it was probably the best uniforms that existed in football. But in my collection, I have, for example, a white helmet. The Eagles worn the white helmets with the green decals from 69 to 1972. I have one game used helmet from that period of time. I also have an Eric Kersey, which he was a punter in 74 and 75 for the Eagles. I have his game used helmet. He doesn't show a lot of usage because, again, he was a punter, so there's only so much hit marks a punter will have on his helmet. That style was the style that came right after the white helmets. They went to the Kelly Greens with the silver wings decal on the helmets. Also, more recently, I have a 2004 Super Bowl game used jersey from the game we talked about from Lozo in Frayne. He was one of the bench players for the Eagles. I actually was able to track him down, and I got the jersey directly from him, which was pretty cool because I think not only the item speaks for itself, but the story behind acquiring the item is also fascinating. And also, I just acquired, this was just like last week, I got a game used Eagles jersey style that the Eagles won between 1956 and 65. But this jersey, this jersey specifically still has the tags in it, the manufacturer tags in it, because a lot of the jerseys have crotch pieces, and those pieces will be cut off over time. So a lot of the Eagles jerseys you find from that period of time, you cannot find the tagging in the jersey itself. But this one still has all the tags, so which is fascinating to me because one of the tags is Mitchell & Ness Sporting Goods, which a lot of people these days know Mitchell & Ness produce a lot of throwback jerseys, throwback retail jerseys. But at the time, they were a manufacturer from Philadelphia, so they produced Eagles jerseys until the 1963 season. So because these jerseys still has the 60, their tag, it was worn until 1963, which it's the number 75, it's on the jersey. So it was at that time, Jim McCusker from Pittsburgh was the one that possibly worn, or it might have been from John Mayers from Washington that he played from 64 to 65, which, by the way, John Mayers is gave me his Eagles helmet. Is at the University of Washington Museum. They have a museum in the school for sports memorabilia, and his family gave me his Eagles helmet to the university. I also have Brian Dawkins, which is my favorite Eagles player all time. I have his 1997 white game used jersey. He has a lot of marks, hit marks, and stains like you expect from a guy that played so aggressively. This was his second year in the league, so it's a very rare jersey. One of my proudest items I found was dug deep on eBay from someone that had no idea what kind of helmet they had. They had advertised it as being a retail helmet. It was, but I ended up finding that it was a 19. So this helmet, the interesting thing about this helmet is that in 1996, the Eagles changed their colors from their Kelly green to the midnight green that they currently use. And so this helmet was a midnight green in 1997 and 1996 current style of jerseys and helmets. When I bought the helmet, I noticed that the inside the shell, he had the old color, the Kelly green, in it. So when I got it in the mail, I noticed that what they did was a 1995 helmet that was reconditioned, and when they reconditioned, they painted it over the Kelly green color. So they painted the midnight green over the Kelly green, and then the inside the helmet there was a name tag, but it was scratched over. So I put some alcohol over that tag, and I was able to erase the scratches, and he ended up being and the helmet was used by Christy Johnson, if I'm not mistaken. Christy Jones, that's who wore the helmet in 1997. So it was one of those finds for $50 that it's actually unique. And, of course, I have other things like Michael Vick game-used pants and even a pylon used in a 2014 game. But of course, you know, I'm always trying to acquire more items.
So I'm curious. You got a lot of Eagles stuff. Did you, or do you have any Pottstown Firebird stuff, memorabilia,
yes,
or anything for in your collection?
Yes, actually, for most people might not know, but in 1968, the Firebirds used the old Philadelphia Bulldogs uniforms, Bulldogs from the CFL. So the team went, DeFilippo, which was the head coach, he was one of the coaches with the Bulldogs. And in 68, the team was looking to acquire some kind of uniforms before they got the relationship with Eagles. So they were able to get, DeFilippo knew where the old uniforms were, and they got them for almost free, because there was no need for these uniforms anymore. I have a 1968 Philadelphia Bulldogs / Pottstown Firebirds game-used jersey that I acquired from the player. Art Eloy was the player from Pittsburgh. And I also got his playbook. He was at training camp with the Eagles in 1969, And then he went on to the Firebirds in 69 because the Eagles sent him to the Firebirds. And so it's just a regular binder that has some stickers on the front that says Pottstown Firebirds. And in the pages, he added up the Eagles playbook and the Firebirds playbook in the same playbook by itself. So I have had two in my collection. Just last week, I was able to find the 60-millimeter tapes, original tapes, from the entire 1969 championship game against the Hartford Knights, where the Firebirds won 20-0. So there's ground footage from the game and just the regular footage from the game. So this week I just bought a 16-millimeter projector just to play those tapes. To my knowledge, these are the only tapes that exist from the 1969 championship game. It was acquired from Norfolk Neptune's trainer because he was a trainer for Norfolk, which Norfolk had a lot of the Firebirds players after they seized in 1970. So I have that too. I might receive this week game used helmet from the Firebirds, which obviously that's also Eagles helmet. I also might receive this week the 1969 championship trophy, which that will be well documented on the website. It's not very easy to find memorabilia of the Firebirds. I noticed that ever since I started taking pre-orders from the book, I started seeing a lot more items floating on eBay. And they could have gone for cheaper than they are going to, the items. But so I see that when these items appear, there's quite the interest on the Firebirds.
Wow, that's awesome. Those are real keepsakes. Can you give us, our listeners, some more information, Bruno, on how can they order your book and how can they get more information on your research and writing?
Sure. So I have the website dedicated to the Firebirds, which basically is PottstownFirebirds.org. That's the website they can go to. And then on the main page, there's the option to order the book via debit card, credit card, PayPal, whatever method they want to. I also made it easy for someone that wants to just send me an email in case they're having difficulties ordering their way. They can just email me. It's pretty easy. It's Bruno, Bruno, at PottstownFirebirds.org. They can email me if they have any questions, if they got any items, any comments, concerns, or how to pre-order the book. And I also added the book on eBay. It's pretty easy. If you search Post on Firebirds, you'll come across that if you want to order that way. So just trying to put different outlets out there. They can make it easy for people to find out about this book. And more will be added as soon as it actually comes out at the end of this month. And of course, there's also for those who have Facebook, I have a page dedicated to the Firebirds where I post updates. Every day I post something new about the Firebirds. It can be a photo, it can be information, it can be an interesting fact. And it's also a good way to connect with some of the players. They're also there. They're on the Facebook page itself for those that still have Facebook. So those are some methods that they can find out more. And also they can go to the website and subscribe to the newsletter at least once a month. I make a new post and I send a new email with a new story because the book might be done, but there's new stories that I come across every day.
Well, what an amazing story. Bruno, we're almost out of time. Again, I urge our listeners to pick up your book and visit your website. Your website is beautiful. Great information, great story there as far as the Firebirds are concerned. You truly are preserving the history of minor league football as far as Pottstown is concerned. You're to be very much commended for your efforts. To me, I'm just I'm so amazed because you're so young and you have such an appreciation of the history of them. It's just so nice to see. And again, I really thank you for being on the show tonight. And again, I urge our listeners, check out your website and check out and purchase your book. I think that's going to be a must for any minor league football fan and collector. Bruno, thank you for being on the show tonight.
Thank you, Bruno.
Thank you.
All right, we're down. We're under 5 minutes, and we're going to be going into our two-minute warning and wrap up. Jeff, fascinating look at one town's history. I mean, if you really think about it, you go from the Maroons to the Firebirds, and you sprinkle the Eagles all around you. What an amazing story, to say the least.
Yeah, you said the word fascinating. I actually wrote that in my notes here I was taking when I was listening to Bruno. You know, I was aware a bit about the minor league teams that were around in the 60s and 70s. You know, a couple of them have card sets. You know, Bruno mentioned the Norfolk Neptunes, who are down here in Virginia. And, you know, occasionally you'll see some Neptunes cards. They had a set, I think it was on the side of dairy cartons at one point. And so you see those pop up. But I really never knew much about the league and the leagues and their affiliation with the NFL. I mean, I did not at all.
Yeah.
I'm almost embarrassed to say I had no idea that there were minor league leagues that were truly affiliated with the NFL at one point. Because,
right.
you know,
right.
as we've talked, the NFL so needs a feeder system other than college for so many reasons.
Right.
And, gosh, the story he's told was just fascinating, and the information he's collected on this team and even the whole set of leagues that were related to this team was just, you know, just an incredible story.
Well,
again, really
it brought back great memories for me for that cusp period of roughly 1965 to 1969. Mm-hmm. There were two different football leagues. I had my minor league Hartford Knights. The Sunday paper was just, you know, an encyclopedia of football information. I would run outside. I distinctly remember Sunday mornings, get the newspaper, bring it inside. And my father would always say, I know you want the sports section, so here it is. And I basically would study it, you know, for the entire week and, you know, just keep reading over the articles, so on and so forth. And again, that was the time when newspapers actually, reported games. You actually had good information, had great statistics, so on and so forth. And it brought back so many nice memories for me to remember that. And again, I distinctly remember being in my room with my radio listening to Hartford Knights football on a Saturday night. And I used to get mad because if we had a storm, the station would cut in and out. So I would have to move around the room with the antenna to try to make sure I could pick it up type of thing. And I always wished I could have gone to a game, but logistically, you know, being a kid, my father didn't want to drive to Hartford on a Saturday night. So obviously, I never got to a game, but great, great, great memories of that time period. And again, I know I told a lot of people on a Sunday, I was always fascinated because I could watch an AFL game and an NFL game on a Sunday afternoon with the two big games, whatever locally was being shown. But, you know, minor league football, especially here on the East Coast, has a fascinating history. And I don't know how many people are or are not aware of, you know, they were minor league teams for both the NFL and the AFL at that time. All right, we're down to less than 90 seconds. As a reminder, we're sponsored in part by MSB Sports Cards. Check out their website at msbsportscards.com. And also by BST Auctions. Please check out their website at bstauctions.com. Jeff, thank you very much for filling in on short notice. And again, thanks for sharing that information on the Maroons. The stuff you have from them is just absolutely incredible, to say the least. It's historical. And I also like to thank Bruno for coming on, who, again, provided us with an incredible amount of information on what is now not a forgotten team of minor league football. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I will be back with a couple shows at the end of the month. Jeff, thanks for being on. I appreciate it. And
thank you,
for
Bob.
Listening.
Enjoy the football games today too. Later on, football today on a Saturday, NFL baby.
Right. And again, on any given Thursday, not Saturday, Sunday, or Monday, anything can happen in the NFL. All right, thanks for listening, and we'll be back. Take care.
All right.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.